Windows or doors sticking? Cracks in your drywall or brickwork? These can be signs of a structural foundation problem. PermaSeal can help with that. Free inspections, transferable warranties, financing, and peace of mind. PermaSeal, 800-421-7325 or permaseal.net.
Want to do a little podcast? What do you say? All right, my friend. Why don't you get your stuff over, organized on your side, and I'll get my stuff organized on my side, and then you hit the button, and then I'll start talking. What do you say? Sounds like a plan. It's pretty much the formula here, isn't it? All right. Well, what do you say? I'm all set. Instrument in fine condition. Get your trigger finger ready, and we'll take this thing for a little spin. What do you say? All right, here we go. Put it in the books. Episode 494. 494. Ooh, six more to go to 500 there, Rich. I'm assuming you're going to be throwing me a party, right? Yeah, you know, I won't be waiting too long for that. All right, 495. Put it in the books. Star, smile, strong. Get ready with that finger. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. But of course, not only is it important to listen, but get out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Of course, if you like what you hear, you can always go to WGNRadio.com and go to the podcast section for this podcast. And what you will find, it will be unbelievable. Podcast after podcast after podcast. What the heck? We've been doing this now for almost 10 years. May of next year will be our 10th anniversary, and we are creeping up ever so quickly on episode 500. So find out where we've been so you know where we're going. And always stay with us. We try to make the ride as fun and as interesting and different and worth listening to and spending an hour or so with us every week as much as we can. So we certainly appreciate your time and your support and your effort, and we try to do the same just for you. So why don't we get started? This is episode 494. So, I've certainly mentioned this on occasions over the last 494 episodes, but I don't know if I've ever really dug deep into my real affection and affinity and respect and I don't even know. What you can call it, almost innate connection to what I think is maybe not just my favorite Elton John album, but my favorite album of all time, and that's quite a statement from somebody that's been listening to music for more than 50 years and who's got thousands of a record collection and CD collection, thousands, and my iPod, as you are well known, has almost 24,000 songs on it. So for me to say that I've even got a favorite album is quite a statement. But I think I will come out and say that, because when all is said and done, for some of the albums that I have had a great connection to and have listened to countless times over my life. Whenever I hear this album, there's just something about it. And we all know, and for those of you, and I put myself in that category, who are big music fans, who music is not just background noise, but it's really something that has added and enriched our lives and has played a major role in it and has influenced us and has entertained us and has made us think and made us feel and made us live. If you fall into that category, then when you talk about your favorite songs or your favorite albums, it means more than maybe to somebody who just listens to music casually. And everybody has their own likes and interests, and there might be some people that are into something more, and you go, well, I don't get that. Well, we all have our thing, and music certainly has been and continues to be my thing. And this year, in May, was the 50th anniversary of the release of the Elton John album, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. Now, if you listen to this podcast, perhaps you would have a hint that, yeah, that Captain Fantastic thing might be something special to Jim. Because after all, that's what this podcast was named after. With my name, Elton Jim, my nickname, Elton Jim. Even though this podcast doesn't talk about Elton John on a regular basis or every episode basis, I thought that the connection with my name, Elton Jim, I would create a persona or an image for the podcast that didn't really necessarily connect with the topics, but would just be an overall general image or brand or whatever you want to call it that ties into me and also is kind of a cool name. And so I came up with Captain Podtastic as opposed to Captain Fantastic. It was an homage to, obviously, Elton John and this album. It was an homage or a connection to my nickname, if I'm going with Elton Jim, to have some kind of an Elton John related thing, maybe subtle or not, but Captain Podtastic. It doesn't have to be it doesn't have to have a Captain Fantastic connection necessarily, because I got the podcast name in there. But if you look at the logo for this podcast, you will see that it mimics the album art logo for Captain Fantastic, using the red and the yellow script that was done by one of the great rock and roll illustrators of all time, Alan Aldridge. And so there's definitely a homage to this album, a connection. I've never been called Captain Podtastic. I would have. That was my goal at some time, perhaps when we first started, that maybe I would be, hey, there's Captain Podtastic or whatever. But hey, that's the way it is. But that was the thinking behind it, and that really runs deep into a lot of things about this album that remain close to me and that I identify with and have continued to identify with since it was released more than, you know, 50 years ago now. And I was just a little kid when I first bought it and first experienced it when it first came out, literally on the first day. And I have many things around in terms of my Elton John collection that are Captain Fantastic memorabilia, about the album itself, whether it's the physical albums and all the iterations, the cassettes, the A-tracks. Yes, the A-tracks. Yes. The different vinyls, the CDs, the different commemorative, editions. There was a 30th edition that came out, obviously 20 years ago. And now there's a 50th anniversary issue that just came out with new extras and things like that. I've got a lot of Captain Fantastic memorabilia displayed in my home and much more even in my collection. I've got two different Captain Fantastic oriented pinball machines. My license plate is Captain Fantastic a vanity plate. You can't spell it out, but I've got a different iteration of it. Hanging from my rearview mirror is one of the bumpers. You know, the little bumpers that light up from the original Bally's Captain Fantastic pinball machine. my screensaver on my phone is the image of Elton John as Captain Fantastic, once again as drawn by Alan Aldridge on the Grammy-nominated cover of the album. These are just off the top of my head, but I mean, I've got bobbleheads and I've got, posters and the original store promo types of, mobiles and, this really cool thing, which I remember as a little kid going to my record store and seeing this and going, oh my God, that is so cool, and not knowing how I could ever get one. And now I have one. I've had it for several years as a promotion for the album when it came out. There was a sign that the record companies made to give to record stores. And it would say open and closed. You'd move the open and you move the closed. But at the same time, it had the Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy logo on it. And I remember walking into my local record store and seeing that and going, oh my God, how much do I want that? And thanks to eBay, several years ago, I found one and I have one and it is proudly displayed. And I've got mirror copies of the album, which I had Elton sign one time. I just got Elton John or Captain Fantastic belt buckles and pins. The one thing they never have made is a Captain Fantastic baseball cap, which I do not understand. And it's been driving me crazy. And I've wanted one for 50 years now. And I had hoped when this 50th anniversary came out that they would finally create a Captain Fantastic cap with this the greatest logo for any Elton John album. It deserves to be on a hat. And in fact, I was so driven to do it that when I saw when this new album came out on Elton John's website, I was saying, okay, now finally they're going to promote this new box set of an anniversary edition for the 50th anniversary. Oh my gosh, well, they have to have a baseball cap now. There wasn't one back then in 1975, and there wasn't one even for the 30th anniversary, and he actually performed 8 of the 10 songs in concert in order. There was a lot of memorabilia, T-shirts and things like that with Captain Fantastic, but no cap. And I was so disappointed that I had my wife do a computer mock-up of a black hat with the Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy logo on it. And I sent it to Elton's organization. And I said, here's the mock-up. Here's the hat. Make this. I've been waiting 50 years for it. Needless to say, I haven't heard anything back, but still. This is a major, it's been a major part of my life. It's my favorite album, for many reasons. Not only is it filled with what I believe is many of Elton John's best songs. They may not be all hits. They many of them were not. In fact, they weren't even released to the radio to become hit singles, except Someone Saved My Life Tonight. But in terms of a complete album, song for song, as a complete unit of 10 connected songs, I believe it is probably his finest work. And I know a lot of people will say, well, what about Goodbye Yellow Brick Road? I mean, my God, 17, double album, 17 songs, so many great songs on there. Funeral for a Friend, Love Lies Bleeding, Candle in the Wind, Benny and the Jets, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, and then some great deep cuts like Gray Seal and Harmony and The Ballad of Danny Bailey, and I've seen that movie too. The list goes on and on. There's very little filler in that 17-song album, no question. But Captain Fantastic is just, you can literally put that, you can either put the needle down on the album if you're playing vinyl these days, or you hit play on that CD player, or you hit play on your mobile device, And you don't have to skip a song. And you can play all 42 minutes and 36 seconds. And it really is just a diverse, beautiful, touching, personal, exceptional album. And there's no question that for me, it has risen in almost immediately, I should say. But only in the last 50 years, it has only become more ingrained. But when this album came out, I just immediately was engrossed by it. First by sight, and next by sound, and I've been obsessed with it ever since. It wasn't something that grew on me. It attacked me. It jolted me. I remember, as I said, going to buy it on the first day, seeing it on the stacked racks at the record store, and it was several racks because Elton John was so popular at the time. They were ready to promote this thing, and the album has become historic in many ways, literally, not just in Elton John's history, but in the history of music. Elton John was so popular at the time that Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy became the first album in history to enter the Billboard charts at number one. First week. Now it's commonplace. That's all you see. Taylor Swift, her new album, debuts at number one, But this was 50 years ago. This was not when we had social media. This was not when we had the internet. This is not when we had MTV. This was based more on popularity, radio airplay, and pure popularity that drove people to go to a record store to make the trek and buy it and bring it home. It wasn't a click. It wasn't a like. You had to put in a little effort. It wasn't saturation. It was word of mouth. It was a whole different time. And for that album to have done that above all other performers or entertainers in music up to that point, before 1975, no album had ever entered the charts at number one. No. Frank Sinatra never did it. Elvis Presley never did it. The Beatles never did it. Nobody ever did it before Elton John and Captain Fantastic in the Brown Dirt Cowboy came out in late May of 1975 and debuted at number one. And ironically, Elton John became the second artist in history to have an album debut at number one. Not surprisingly, it was his next album, released later in 1975, around October and November. Rock of the Westies became the second album in history to debut at number one. That's how big Elton John was in 1975. So what I'd like to do today is to perhaps either for those of you who are Elton John fans to have a little discussion about this album, why it's so important and why it's been so important to me. But for the casual listener, I hope you'll stay with us today. And perhaps this is an album that you may have heard of. Perhaps it isn't. Perhaps you've never heard of it. Maybe you heard me talk about the title and the name, and maybe you heard me talk about the album on and off, but you've never heard it. And what my goal is to hopefully, if you stick around for the next hour or so, I hope that you'll check this album out. You'll go online, wherever you go to find music, I hope that you'll check this album out and see if I'm not crazy or not. Oh, well, of course you love it. It's Elton John. Well, there might be some truth to that. But on the other side, it's just a great album. It was nominated for Album of the Year of the Grammys, lost to Paul Simon's Still Crazy After All These Years, which isn't surprising. Back in the 70s, the Grammy Awards were completely different as well. Today, they are truly a popularity contest. The Grammys have turned in t- to something completely different than what they were. When they were established, the Grammy Awards were, and still are, but they're less influenced by, the industry. There is a group of Grammy voters, and they are not the public. They are people within the industry. They are producers and songwriters and engineers and executives. There are people in the business voting on the best music based on the professional, from a professional point of view. This is a peer-based award. It's not a popularity contest. Now, in the last, I would say, 25 years, it has become that. CBS turned it into a more of a TV show than an award show, sadly. And so it's become a popularity contest now. But back in those days, it was really an industry kind of insider thing. And it was a little snobbish, the Grammys, no question about that. And in those days, in the 70s especially, if you look at the Grammy winners, they were dominated by two or three artists for the most part. American, the Grammys are basically, American-based, professionals who were voting. Back then, there was a little bias because the British influence was so big, especially since the Beatles in 64, that by the 70s, American, the American side of the music business wanted to flex its muscles, and it seemed like the Grammy Awards were that their way of doing that. So while they certainly acknowledged many of the English artists, because how could you not? At the same time, the British artists didn't win as many Grammy Awards, especially in the 70s, as you would have thought. When you hear some of these great albums or these great bands or these great artists of the 70s and even of the early 80s, you would think, the Beatles must have 45 Grammy Awards, right? Yeah, I mean, Elton John must have 45 Grammy Awards, and Pink Floyd must have, 50 Grammy Awards, and The Who must have 25. No, not at all. And so basically the 70s, in terms of Grammy Awards, seemed to have been dominated quite a bit by American artists. The music business, it's changed certainly because now people can record in their basements. But back then, the music industry was basically but it was established on both coasts. The New York recording studios and the West Coast studios. Yes, there's some other studios around the country. Of course, there were some in Chicago here, the famous Sun Studio, obviously, in Memphis, and there's a Caribou Ranch. There were a lot of studios, the Stax Records in Memphis. There's a lot of famous studios, don't get me wrong. But when it came to recording albums, most of the big groups were either recording in New York or in Los Angeles. That's where the entertainment business was booming and pretty much settled on both coasts, and that's where the big record recording studios were located. And so that's where most of the music people lived, and it became a very small, tight-knit world. And that became a lot of the people who voted for the Grammys. And so these were friends, or they were peers, and they were people that worked together on a regular basis. And those were the kind of people that wound up getting acknowledged with the Grammy Awards. Not that they were undeserving by any means, but it wasn't always a reflection of what was popular. In fact, in many ways, as I said before, the Grammys were kind of looked at as the more elite, part of the music business of the award show. There was the American Music Awards, which was a Dick Clark kind of bandstand produced show, and that was the one where the fans voted, and so many of the the most popular artist would walk away with the American Music Awards. But when it came to the Grammys, they were considered like, you know, the Oscars. They were considered, well, this, you know, there's the Golden Globes, which are the popular, you know, fan-based kind of awards. And then there's the Academy Awards, which are voted on by people in the industry. And it was the same way with the Grammys. There was the American Music Awards at the time in the 70s, which was this big television show with all the stars and so the awards played into the audience they were after, the young teenage audience, and they weren't looking to have obscure winners. They wanted the big stars to win, so the big stars would show up and the people would watch. That's what it was all based on. And but the Grammys at the time, initially, was viewed as kind of the gold standard. As I said before, I think in the last 25 years or so, there was a definite change and shift in how the voting was viewed. I think CBS, which carried the Grammys for many years, I think they basically said to the Grammys, look, you guys are getting killed every year in the ratings. I know this is some prestigious thing, but it's also a TV show, and we need to get some ratings, and we need to make some money. And your show just ain't cutting it, because the best albums or the best songs are songs that nobody's heard of. And so I think there was a deliberate shift within the Grammys to give more attention to and more official acknowledgement to more of the most popular artists and the popular songs of the day. The show itself, the Grammy Award ceremony, certainly has now just become more of a show about performances and duets and, you know, and all that stuff, as opposed to actually giving out the awards. But my whole point is that back in the 70s, the Grammys were not as populist-based. And back then, it seemed like Paul Simon, who was big on the West Coast, or on the East Coast, he was a New York guy, he won a lot of Grammys. And of course, Stevie Wonder walked away with Grammy after Grammy after Grammy in the 70s. Once again, not undeserved by any means. But it was pretty much the 70s were dominated Grammy-wise by Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon in many ways. And don't get me wrong, there's other people that won some Grammys, but Elton did not win, for instance. Elton John, who had an incredible decade, at least from 1972 to 1976, you can't deny that, 7 consecutive number one albums, and yet he never won a Best Album Grammy. Had 7 consecutive number one albums from 1972 to 1975, 7 consecutive number one albums, and he never won a Grammy for Best Album. He never won a Grammy for Best Song during those years. With all those greatest hits from 1972 to 1975, never had a number one, never won a Grammy for a Best Song or Record of the Year. But nominated, but never won. So you have the Fantastic, once again, nominated for Album of the Year and nominated for its album packaging, Alan Aldridge, as I talked before, and I'll talk about that later, but did not win. But regardless of that, as I said, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy album really made history. As I said, first album to ever enter the charts at number one. But it also has become a part of my own personal history as well. And so I'd like to share some of that reason why and some of the kinds of things that why this album is so important. And hopefully at the end of the day, you'll even be, if you're just even minusculely intrigued or questioning about, well, the way he's talking about this, maybe I should listen. Oh, then I've done my job. If you just go online or you go to wherever you go for your music, and if you give Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy just one listen, You may never listen to it again. But if you give it just one listen, then I'll be happy that at least you heard it. And maybe it will strike a chord for you. Maybe it won't. But I'd love to at least have been able to move you to at least listen to the album in its entirety, because it needs to be listened to that in that way, and I'll tell you why. But a little backdrop, let me give you a first, because it's important to understand the context of when this album was released, of why it was such a sensation in many ways, and why for me it was such a sensation and remains one. Aside from its musical excellence, lyrically, musically, the performance of the band, the production by Gus Dudgeon, all of it. I really believe it's a flawless album. Everyone involved in the creation of this album, Elton John music and vocals, Bernie Taupin lyrics, Davy Johnstone, Nigel Olsen, Dee Murray, Ray Cooper, as the band, I mean, you know, what more can you say? Gus Dudgeon on production, Alan Aldridge, the illustrator, David Larkham, the art director, everybody involved in this project just rose to the occasion. And that's why, to celebrate its 50th anniversary, it really deserves it. What's ironic about Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, it is Elton John's, in my view, best album. It's historic for entering the charts at number one, the first time an album did that. And it's got one of Elton John's greatest hits on it, Someone Save My Life Tonight. Grammy nominated, right? So it's got all those milestones. And yet, I think it's probably, even though in my view it's his best album, I also think it's his most underappreciated album, which would seem completely in conflict. It would seem to be, doesn't make any sense, but it's one of the great ironies. It's probably his best complete 10-song, song-for-song album, number one album, history-making, in fact, and yet somehow it's his most underappreciated album, and I'll get into that. But you have to understand, as I said before, a little context. 1975 for Elton John, few artists ever had a year like Elton John did in 1975. And I'm talking about Taylor Swift, I'm talking about Michael Jackson, I'm talking about Madonna, I'm talking about Elvis Presley, I'm talking about the Beatles, okay? Those are the biggest names in music in many ways, historically as well as contemporary. But I would say that if you put Elton John's 1975 up against any of those bands' greatest years, they would be tough to match what Elton did in 1975. And that's the context of which Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy was released. Here's just a few little bullet points about Elton John's 1975. You tell me if this is not impressive. So the year starts out, and he's got the number one song of the year, the first of the year. The year begins, and Elton's already got the number one song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It was a one-off single. It's not on the Captain Fantastic album. It's been added as bonus tracks now on later CD versions, and if you go on to the different streaming services. But the actual album only has 10 songs. And Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, while it was recorded during the sessions of Captain Fantastic at the Caribou Ranch in Colorado in 1974, it was not on the album. But Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, obviously the John Lennon-written Beatles song, which John Lennon does actually appear on. He does backing vocals and plays some rhythm guitar. That was the number one song. It was released in late 1974 and was a number one song. Still being played heavily on the radio when the year began. So, you got a number one song right off the bat. Elton's first album, Empty Sky, which was released in 1969 in England, was never released in the United States. It came and went. It wasn't really an album of note. But it was literally his first album with Bernie Taupin. And so given his now tremendous fame, finally it was released here in the United States in 1975 at the beginning of the year. In February, Elton appears on a TV show in America that was hosted by Cher before she got her regular show. So Elton comes on the Cher show, Cher special, and performs Benny and the Jets with Cher, performs Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, his number one song, Alone, and then later appears in a few skits and also does a few rock classics with Cher and Bette Midler. Flip Wilson, another guest on the variety show. And Elton's all dressed up in some crazy bubble top hat costume. It's pure Elton John. It's the Elton John of the 70s that you'd want to see. And it's available on YouTube if you want to see it. But now he's on national television doing that. Then in March, he follows up Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds with another number one song, Philadelphia Freedom. So just while that other song was losing and going down the charts and not being played anymore, Lucy in the Sky, after it had been on for a couple, 3 months, then he comes right back with another one-off single. Philadelphia Freedom, once again, recorded during the sessions of the Captain Fantastic album at the Caribou Ranch in the summer of 1975 or 1974. But not on the official album. As I said, now it's been added as a bonus track on many of the extended versions on CDs and things like that, but not on the original album. That song comes out and becomes number one. So he follows that up. He follows up Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds as a number one with another number one 3 months later, maybe 2.5 months later, with Philadelphia Freedom, one of his biggest hits of all time. Then he appears and sings Philadelphia Freedom and Benny and the Jets on Soul Train and becomes the first white performer ever to appear on the black-oriented music show Soul Train. So makes history again in 1975. Then, after that, he's on television again, hosting a very short-lived thing called the Rock Awards, and he was host with Cher and Diana Ross. Then, in the summer, beginning of summer, he appears in a film version of The Who's concept album, Tommy, as the Pinball Wizard, singing the Pinball Wizard, which appears on the soundtrack, and which, while never officially released as a single, has become one of his most popular songs because of the great version that he did of Pinball Wizard, which is obviously a legendary song in its own right. But Elton's take became a very popular version, and he does a great job, and his band sounds great, and his piano sounds amazing on that. Then comes Captain Fantastic in May of 1975. This is just the first 5 months of the year, folks. For some people to have done one of these things in a year would be enough. This is just the first 4 or 5 months this has all been happening. Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy comes out in late May, and as I said, becomes historic for being the first album to ever enter the Billboard charts, album charts, at number one. And it stayed there for 7 straight weeks. That's almost 2 months. On June 21st, he has a huge concert day-long concert in London at Wembley Stadium, which included the Beach Boys and Rufus and the Eagles and Joe Walsh, of which he debuted the Captain Fantastic album live for the first time. In July of 1975, he was on the cover of Time magazine with the banner that said "Rocks Captain Fantastic." "Someone Saved My Life Tonight" ultimately went to number 4 on the U.S. charts. Didn't become number 1, but was number 4. In August, he returned to the club that basically started his career here in the United States, the famous Troubadour Club, which is still open in West Hollywood. And he did a special 5th anniversary, a series of shows there to celebrate his 5 years of fun, if you will. And so he went there and did this, now at this point, he's playing stadiums. And he was playing this small club that holds about 250 people. Pretty momentous kind of two shows. Then, in late September, early August, "Rock of the Westies" is released. And that goes into the charts at number 1. Now the second album in history. And that was Elton's 7th consecutive number 1 album in the United States, beginning in 1972. It was quite a record. His song "Island Girl" from "Rock of the Westies" is released and becomes a number 1 song. His third number 1 song in 1975, and the other one was number 4. And 2 number 1 albums. And overall, 7 consecutive number 1 albums since 1972. And he caps off the year in October, on October 25th and 26th, of playing 2 sold-out shows at Dodger Stadium. And he was the first rock act to play Dodger Stadium since the Beatles played there in 1966. More than 100,000 people over those 2 shows. Record-breaking and once again historic. And that was Elton John's 1975. Not a bad year for an artist, right? And so within that context, within that, and let's not forget that when he was in L.A. for those shows in October, then he also got a star on the Walk of Fame. And the mayor of Los Angeles proclaimed that week that Elton was there at Dodger Stadium is Elton John week. Okay, so it's not much more you can get. And within that context, as I said, Elton John releases this album called Captain Fantastic and the Brown-Eared Cowboy. Now, you should understand that the title itself refers to Captain Fantastic, Elton John, and the Brown-Eared Cowboy, Bernie Taupin. Bernie Taupin writes the lyrics for Elton John and has since they got together in 1967. And at this point in their career, Bernie first wrote these lyrics in mid 1974. The album came out in 75. It was recorded in the summer of 75 or 74. As I said before, at the Caribou Ranch in Colorado, which sadly now has been closed, but it was the home to not only some of Elton's best recordings in his career, as I said, Losing the Sky, Philadelphia Freedom, Captain Fantastic, the Caribou album, which had The Bitches Back, and Don't the Sun Go Down on Me, also recorded there. That's why he named it Caribou after the recording studio. Captain Fantastic, Rock of the Westies, another number one album with a number one song, Island Girl, also recorded there, as well as Philadelphia Freedom and Lucy in the Sky and many other B-sides. So a very prolific and a very, exceptional period of time from 1974 during that time. You could argue that it may have been maybe his best period of recording and writing. in one consecutive kind of time. But as I said, at this point, their fame was so huge and their rise was so fast. They came to America in 1970, complete unknowns. And as I said before, after his August stand in 1970 at the Troubadour Club, he literally became an overnight sensation with gaining rave reviews, especially one written by Robert Hilburn at the time of the New York Times, of the Los Angeles Times. And it really started his career on an upward trajectory, which has remained now for 55 years. And so I think that at the time, Bernie devised this concept album to sort of tell the story of Elton John and Bernie Taupin. He gave them obviously different personas and different pseudonyms, but it's basically their story. And viewing Elton as the flamboyant, successful rock star that he was of the day, the biggest star in the world, not even arguably, but definitively at that time, like I just said, as I ran over all that, what a great name to come up with. Captain Fantastic. What else could you say? The name says it all. And for Bernie, he named himself the Brown Dirt Cowboy. Bernie Taupin was born in a rural northern part of England, in the Lincolnshire market raisin kind of area there. And so he fashioned himself as this kind of rural brown dirt cowboy. And thus the name of the album. And thus the theme of the album and the concept of the album. Almost like a fable. Almost like a Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid kind of story. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if that title, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, wasn't inspired by Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, when you consider that that movie came out in about 1972 or 73. Or maybe it was earlier than that. But my point is, it was a very popular show, and it was this, a movie, and it was this kind of fable of this origin story of these two people that got together and did something important. And, you know, you have to remember that Bernie Taupin, while both of them were young, Bernie Taupin, in 1970, when they first hit with Your Song, was only 20 years old. Elton was 23, which is still not old. But Bernie was you know, 20 years old. When he wrote Your Song, he was 19. So even by 1974, consider the stratospheric fame that they had achieved, as I said, that 3 or 4 year period from 72 to 75, especially, 7 consecutive number one albums, number one songs, the fame, the touring, everything. What a whirlwind it must have been. And, you know, Bernie Taupin had a unique perspective and view of all that fame, because while he certainly was a important catalyst in creating all of that, in fact, his songs, his lyrics come first. I'm sure by this point most people know that Elton John does not write lyrics. He is completely dependent on lyric writers, and for the most fame and the most success he's had have been with Bernie Taupin lyrics. So Bernie Taupin is really the muse and the creative catalyst for Elton's songs. It is Bernie's lyrics that inspire Elton's melodies and the way he'll sing a song. But it's Bernie's words that he connects with so much. And what made this album, and what still makes this album, and if you listen to it, like I hope you will, listen to the passion and the clear emotional connection of how Elton is singing these lyrics. Because in many ways, while Elton has sung the words of Bernie Taupin, and in many ways, Bernie has written in Elton's voice so that it would sound as if Elton is literally saying these things and feeling these things, coming up with these ideas. But they're Bernies. But that's what makes their partnership so unique, is that Bernie Taupin was able to understand Elton so well that he could write from Elton's frame of mind. Bernie was definitely giving his own views and perspectives, but he was also giving something that Elton could still grab onto, that still could relate to, in order to write a melody to it. And so when you have songs like Rocket Man or Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, or Daniel, or, you know, all of these timeless songs, while they were Bernie Taupin creations, Elton still was able to find a connection. Even a song like Tiny Dancer, which was originally written at the time about Bernie's girlfriend, future first wife, Maxine, you can feel the real emotion that Bernie Taupin poured into those lyrics, but you can also feel Elton connecting to those words and singing them with Bernie's emotion, because he understood Bernie's love for her and conveyed that through that melody and certainly through his lyric. So that's what's so magical about their partnership, is that it's two people, but they really in some way melded together, not just musically, but personally. And they really did. As the story goes, you know, they met through both responding to an ad looking for songwriters. And when Ray Williams took Bernie Taupin's lyrics and gave them to Elton, said, "Well, I know you can't write lyrics, but, you know, here's some lyrics. Try to write to these." Bernie moved from rural Lincolnshire, 2.5 hours away from London, and moved in at 17 years old, 17, and lived with Elton and his mom and his stepfather and his grandmother until they made it big. I mean, think about the realities of that. A 17-year-old kid moves from this rural upbringing to the suburbs of London, never met this person before, was literally put together, was like a blind date. They had no reason to have ever met, given their geographical distance. They never should have met. But fate really put them together. That's the only way. Like Romeo and Juliet, they were star-crossed. There's no other way to describe it. It's pure fate. It seems as if it was ordained to happen, because from a logical standpoint, it makes no sense. But it did happen. And wow, did it happen. But think about that. A 17-year-old kid, not only think about what he did, he moved, never been to London before. He's going to move in and live with these people, with this guy that he's met a couple of times. And they're going to write songs together? 17 years old? Elton was 20 at the time? I mean, how crazy is that? What must Bernie's parents? I mean, kudos to both of their parents. Kudos to Bernie's parents for allowing their son at 17 years old to follow this crazy dream. Certainly a crazy dream when you think about what his surroundings were and what his peers were doing, to go to the city to be a songwriter or a poet and then live with some strange family. I don't know what the arrangements were. I don't know what the financial arrangements were, but wow, just on the merits of support and love and trust for parents, I've got to say Bernie's parents really were either, you know, just insightful or loving and trusting, whatever it was. But wow, to let their kids go, and then Elton's mother and stepfather at the time to to take this kid in because their son wants to write songs with him? Who is he? Is he a crazy person? Is he? What is he? Who is he? Why is he? Wow. The trust and the love and the support that both of their parents must have had to invest and support their young children's dreams. You have to admire that. And, you know, you could look back and if it hadn't worked, it would have been like, okay, whatever. But they still took the risk. They still took the chance. They still didn't put the kibosh on it and say, oh, this is silly, you know, and you're not going to move in with them. Or no, we're not going to have this kid move in with us. You know, they could have easily done that. And most parents may have done that, but they didn't. And wow, what a life-changing, what a history-making decision those sets of parents made. They made that happen in many ways. Yes, their children had the talents and the drive and the ambition. But wow, you shouldn't forget the role of those parents. They made a heck of a difficult decision, but I'm sure it was a decision that was made in pure support and love. But anyway, that's basically what the Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy album describes. Given all that fame that they received so fast, even at age 24, it seems that Bernie Taupin was being a little reflective. He was a little jaded and a little disappointed and a little angry, I guess would be the word, about the music world and attaining those goals and those dreams that they had always thought of. You don't think about the underbellies and the dark sides of what fame and celebrity and fortune may be. And certainly as a teenager, I'm sure Bernie didn't. But then he had experienced it like few others had. And while he certainly lived and indulged in it, he was also a poet and a lyric writer, and so he also got introspective about it and reflective about it. He realized what he was in. He was an observer of life, as most poets and writers are, and so he was able to take that experience, take that disappointment, take that disillusionment, but also remember when their lives and their beginnings were much more simple and much more filled with hope and much more optimistic and driven by ambition. And so that's what he chose to write about in the 10 songs for Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. The 10 songs don't deal with Elton John and Bernie Taupin's amazing fame that they originally achieved up to 1974. But rather, it covers a two-year period from 1967 when they met to 1969, as I said earlier, with the release of their first album in 1969, an album called Empty Sky. It didn't do anything. Didn't do anything in England. It wasn't even released here in the United States. But it was the culmination for them of a dream, of a goal, of what would seem to be an unthinkable goal, to have made an album back in those days. Wow. Now people make them in their basements. But there was a whole process. You had to be discovered. You have to be signed by a record company. You have to go and record it. Then you have to write the songs and then record it. And then it's whatever. There was a whole process. All that's different now. But back in 1969, that was the way it went. So the odds were so against anybody, and the odds were so against these two even meeting, that regardless if they meet, and then they come together, and Bernie lives with Elton's family, and then they actually write songs. They find that they can write songs, and people like them enough that they actually get a chance to make an album. And so that's what this covers. It covers the 2 years of their beginnings, not the fame that they eventually would achieve, but the early years, the hungry years, the struggle years. Many times, if you talk to successful people, while certainly the achievement of when they make it big is certainly something that they will never forget, but then when they get to the top, they will always think back of those early times. The struggle, the uncertainty, the insecurity, the failures, the disappointments, and those actually become kind of misty watercolor memories of remember of a simpler time. And it seems like that's what Bernie Taupin was going through. He was looking back at the last several years, and he was longing for those days when it was just Reg, that was Elton John's real name, Reginald Kenneth Dwight, when it was just Reg and Bernie, kind of on their own, the two of them out to conquer the world. And ultimately, they did just that. But there was a time when they didn't, when they didn't know what the future would bring. And there were disappointments, and there were failures, and there was, as I said before, the dark side of the music business, the people, the leeches and the groupies and the record executives and the people that were giving them good advice or bad advice, and people that were trying to take advantage of them financially. That all goes on. Everybody you talk to in the music business sadly goes through that. When there's a lot of money to be made, it draws in a lot of different elements of people. And so Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy is very much like a bittersweet fable or tale of, you know, this partnership that really, as I said before, never should have even happened. And yet it did. And so there's an innocence to it. There's a naivete in the lyrics, in the music. There's introspection, retrospection, emotion, humor. You could feel the passion. You could feel the sadness. You could feel the disappointment. But you could also feel the partnership and the bond between them that they forged as a 17-year-old and 20-year-old, and as writing partners, as his friends. And Elton has often described Bernie as the brother he never had and was always searching for, which is one reason why 55 years later, even more than that, you know, 58 years later, they are perhaps closer than ever. It wasn't just a professional partnership. It was a personal partnership. And you could hear and feel that in Bernie's lyrics and in Elton's melodies, and especially in his expressive lyrics on this album. And that's what makes this album so special. As Elton has said many times, for the first time in his career, when he was writing to Bernie's lyrics, he didn't have to imagine anything. He didn't have to put himself, perhaps, into Bernie's situation to understand this, like I said, in Tiny Dancer, of being in love with this young woman who he'd eventually marry. Because now the songs that Bernie had given Elton for the Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy album, Elton lived these minutes, these moments. He lived these lyrics. These were lyrics that Bernie wrote through pure shared experiences that they both had. And so when Elton picked up these lyrics and began writing them and reading them and writing to them, he was writing from a completely new perspective for the first time. It was as if he had written these. He didn't have to imagine or pretend. These lyrics connected with him. He understood every reference. He understood every line that Bernie was writing, because they both live them. Taupin wrote about their shared experience, and Elton immediately connected. And you can hear that connection, as I said before, in the lyrics, in the music, and in the way Elton performs these songs, especially vocally. And so, you know, it's about, you know, their personal backgrounds and how they came together. It's about their musical remembrances of real people and places and occurrences and the moods and, as I said before, the disappointments and the hopes and the dreams and the disappointments. And Bernie wrote some of the best lyrics and some of the best turn phrases of his entire career on this album. And apparently it was a very easy album for Elton to write. He was on a cruise on a ship called the SS France. And in 1974, he wrote the music to the entire album using the cruise ship's piano during the lunch break when the band and the singers weren't using it. And he wrote the entire album while he was on this cruise, you know, an hour or so at a time. it's you know, his talent is ridiculous. It really is. But as I said before, I think the songs just poured out of him because for the first time, he connected with these songs. And, you know, in terms of the band and itself, oh my gosh. The producer, I think, Gus Dudgeon, who produced all those great albums in the 70s for Elton John, this is his best performance in terms of the production, the sound, the way the piano sounds, the way he mixed the entire band, the band itself, as I said before, of Davy Johnstone and Nigel Olsen and Dee Murray and Ray Cooper, they all are at the top of their game. They all are playing as one unit. Each of them individually gives probably one of the best performances they ever have given. And then collectively as a band, everybody sounds so tight. And Gus Dudgeon captured that sound. It's really the band, the production, Elton, Bernie, everyone involved at their full potential. And that's why this album, 50 years later, still resonates. And ironically, Elton has become Captain Fantastic. And Bernie Taupin did become the Brown Dirt Cowboy. Ultimately, back in the 90s, he bought a ranch in Santa Barbara and literally became a cowboy. He raised bulls and rode horses and went to rodeos. He was the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And meanwhile, that same time, Elton John was Captain Fantastic. But the glasses and the costumes and later the movies and the plays and the philanthropy and the legendary biggest, one of the biggest stars in the world. It just, everything just came together for once and for all. And it really is a special album. And as I said, I remember as a little kid going to the store with my mom, going to the record store, and I see the albums in the stacked, record, in the shelves. They were stacked like three all across, just the album, just everywhere. Because as I said, this thing sold 1.4 million copies in a week. And I bought one of those. And I remember seeing this album cover first is what struck you about it. Seeing that logo, this Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy logo, that Captain Fantastic logo, which burned an image into my retinas that is still there, and that's why it's the logo for this podcast. Look at the album cover and look at my logo. That's where it came from. And I remember looking at this, and there's this illustration of Elton flying on a piano. And he's got this, he looks like Captain Fantastic. And then on the backside of the album, on the cover, there's Bernie Taupin in this little bubble, in this kind of idyllic, pastoral bubble with his pen and his paper. You know, Elton and Bernie are really two different people. They are, as Bernie Taupin has, described them, they're like chalk and cheese. Their views, their temperaments, in many ways, their hobbies are very different, but somehow opposites attract, and that's what made the tale of Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, this tale, these 10 songs of which it tells their origin story and then their struggles. And then the album ends at the beginning of their goals beginning to come true with the recording and the release of their first album. That's where it goes. It's a short period of time. It's condensed, but Taupin takes you through Elton's early engagement, which was called off, thankfully, when he was 20 years old or 21 years old. Bernie's homesickness of wanting of being away from home and his friends and his roots. Now in the city, not feeling very comfortable. As I said before, the pressures of this music business, especially on young people, being taken advantage of and seeing the kind of slimy and manipulative people that were involved and, oh, they're all your best friend until you can't help them anymore. That's all there. And then as the album goes on, toward the end, it really becomes a celebration of Elton John and Bernie Taupin's relationship and their songwriting, a song called Writing, about their newfound craft. And then it ends with two beautiful songs that are connected. One song, I think, is one of Elton's most beautiful love songs ever, called We All Fall in Love Sometimes, which is basically about a bond of two people falling in love, not romantic love, but a brotherly love, a partnership love. And then the song Curtains really talks about and reflects on their relationship as friends and as writers, and culminates in the end of their story as it's beginning. Now it's going to be really take off. There's still uncertainty, but there's a ray of hope. Amongst all the disappointment and the struggle and the disillusionment, the album ends on a hopeful note because they made their first album. They achieved their goal. They don't even know what's next, which is going to be unbelievable. But just the achievement of that first album at the time was a glorious moment in their lives. Before they became superstars, they had that special bond of they were just Reg and Bernie before they became Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. It's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful concept, and it was perfectly executed musically, lyrically, performance-wise, production-wise, and as I said, even album packaging-wise. When I picked up that album off that rack, not only was I mesmerized by the front and the back of the album, which was obviously shrink-wrapped, but it was heavy. It was substantial. It was thick. Now, I remember me and my mom went. I bought the album, and we went to a department store that had a small little diner eating area in it, and I could close my eyes and picture exactly where we sat. And I remember being in the green booth, the dark green booth, and I slid open the shrink wrap. And when I opened up this album, it was like, I can still remember it. It was like, what a revelation. I opened it up, and there's pictures of Elton John and Bernie Taupin in the band. And then I look inside, and I pull the album out, and there's the white, you know, the white little cover that the album comes in, but it was cut out. And the record label had the Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy logo and caricature on the record label with the songs that were on each side. How cool was that? It just didn't say MCA Records or Capitol Records. They took the album art and they put it on the record label. How cool was that? And so I saw that, and I'm like, whoa, how cool is this? I mean, this album cover is already blowing my mind, and now it's even on the record label. How cool is that? And it was, and it was a fold out, gatefold album cover. That means it was two slits, not just the one where you just open it, but just fold it out. So that means there's another opening. And then I feel that there's something in there, and I pull out this stuff, and there's two books and a poster of the album cover. Oh my God, how cool is this? I couldn't wait to hang it up in my room. And then there's two books. There's an album, the lyric book, and then there's a thing called Scraps, which details this two-year era that is explained in the album. So it shows Elton and Bernie as little kids and goes up to 1969 or 1970. It reflects the exact time with Elton's diary recordings and pictures of them and their early career. Oh, it was so well put together. And the illustrations by, once again, Alan Aldridge, then in the lyric book as well. But this scrapbook has these pictures of a young Elton and Bernie as literally his diary entries from 1967, 1968, 1969. There's a great piece in the official Scraps book from the Captain Fantastic album in which Elton writes on a certain day in 1969, and it's all matter of fact. Went to the store, did this with and at the end it says, wrote your song. As if no big deal. That was the last thing he listed. The first thing was going out with some friends to some place. Oh, and by the way, I happened to write your song. It's almost a casual throwaway. What a moment in his life and in the life in the history of music. But at the time, he's a 22-year-old kid who goes, oh, by the way, I wrote your song today. And so this album just was it attacked all of your senses. It attacked your eyes. As I said so many times here, you know, we're a visual society. It was a visual treat. It was a sonic treat. It was a literary treat. It had it all. And I think that's why it stays so with me, aside from the songs, which you cannot deny are great, great, exceptional songs. But for a 11-year-old kid at the time, oh my God, I was blown away. And as I said, that's why I gave you that context of 1975. In the midst of all this, Elton is the biggest star in the world, and I am a huge, huge fan, and I've been a fan for like 2.5 years at that time, and it culminates in this. I'm already excited at the fact that I've seen Elton on TV, on Cher, and on these rock awards, and he's had this number one songs now in a row, and he's had all these albums, and I've been there since, you know, 1973, and enjoying all this. But this 1975 is blowing my mind. I'm wearing Elton John t-shirts every day, and then this album comes out and totally blows my mind for an 11-year-old kid. Whoa. I think that's why this album, aside from the music, is so important to me, because we all cling to what we and remember and we cherish whatever happened to us musically, whatever our memories is. When we were little kids, we just hold on to those for the rest of our lives when something really makes an important impression on us. And this album, in every sense of the way, made that impression on me. And when I hear those songs today, boy, do I flash back to that booth at the Woolworths at Six Corners in Chicago on the Northwest Side when I first opened that album. And I remember going home, then I couldn't wait to get home. And I put it in my record player, and then I hear the first strains of the first song of the album, which fittingly is called Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And that is an overview of the entire story of them, how individually and then how they come together and how they become this amazing duo. And I have to say that one of the greatest lyrics in Bernie Taupin's entire career is within the first line of Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. I think it's 8 words. Captain Fantastic, raised and regimented, hardly a hero. 8 words. Those 8 words sums up the entire concept of this Elton John, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy album, concept, theme, fable, if you will. Captain Fantastic, raised and regimented, hardly a hero. Just someone his mother might know. And yet, that sums it up, because Elton John should never have become a huge rock star. He was hardly a hero. He was hardly the rock star prototype. But he had an amazing talent. He has an amazing talent. But the odds of him making it, especially in those days, were crazy. And one of the best turned phrases in Bernie Taupin's lyrical career, raised and regimented. You say, Jim, what's so great about that? What are you carrying on for? Let me explain why that one lyric still sends goosebumps. Raised and regimented. First of all, beautiful alliteration from a literary standpoint by Bernie Taupin. The R sound, raised and regimented. But more than that, the regimented, it works on so many levels. First of all, as I told you earlier, Elton John's real name is Reginald Kenneth Dwight. Reggie. Reg. He was known as Reg. His father was in the British Air Force. His upbringing was very strict, as is in the military service. Very regimented, right? Or regimental, like in the military. And Reg, as in Reginald Kenneth Dwight. He was raised and regimented, both in name and in upbringing and in influence. That one phrase, that one word, regimented, describes Elton John and his upbringing. That one word, regimented. A lot of other words you could have used, but no word more perfectly phrased to capture the essence of him. He was Reg, and he was regimented, and he continues to be. He's very particular. What a great line. What a great line. And that's what makes this album for me just so timeless, is that it is, as I said, I'm sure that when Elton read that line, he had to have gotten goosebumps. And then the album continues. So it gives you the background, and then it says, you know, from the end of the world, ends with the tagline, from the end of the world to your town, which sums up what Elton and Bernie were doing in 1975. They were at the end of the world. They should never have been together. Bernie up in the north of England, Elton in the suburbs of London. And somehow they came together, and now not only they come together, but now their talent brought them to your town via the tours and their music. They were at the ends of the world, but now they came to your town. Once again, Taupin just nailing it there. It's a song called, Tower of Babel, which talks about it's a very stinging diatribe with Taupin denouncing in biblical proportions about the debauchery and the darkness and the self-indulgence and the phoniness of the music business that, you know, Elton and Bernie began to encounter as they got more into the business as young people. They realized that, that how slippery fame can be and how luck and disappointment and dreams, they're all intertwined, and it's a very difficult struggle. And then as they got together as a music writing band, they got signed by Dick James to be songwriters, which is amazing at their age. But then they were being the pressure to, okay, now we've signed you as songwriters, make us some songs, make us some hits. Elton was not even supposed to be the singer. They were hired as kind of old Tin Pan Alley kind of songwriters to come up hits, write songs for other people, like they did in the Disney movies and things like that, or Sammy Kahn and Johnny Mercer and all these other people. And it was that got them into writing, then realizing we don't want to be pop jingle songwriters. We want to write what we want to write about. And he and the song Bitter Fingers talks about that. It's hard to write a song with bitter fingers. When you don't want to write for someone else, you want to write for yourself. Another great, a song called Tell Me When the Whistle Blows talks about Bernie feeling homesick, leaving his rural roots and wondering, will his friends still think he's, will they think he's some city slicker now, or he's too cool for them? And he misses home. He misses his friends. He misses his family. He misses that rural upbringing. He knows he has to come to the city to realize his dreams, but he's also really realizing that he still misses that old life. There's almost a guilt that he's left there and misses that, and wonders if the people that he knew will still like him. He's kind of a country boy in a city boy's clothing. So it's a very nostalgic and reflective songs about longing for his days in Lincolnshire, but also realizing that he has to come here to realize his goals. And so the whole idea of Tell Me When the Whistle Blows is Bernie frequently taking a trip back home on the train from London back home to see his parents and see his friends, and how he couldn't wait to go back, but realize he also have to come back to London to fulfill his dreams and realize his destiny. Then, of course, there's Someone Saved My Life Tonight. Elton was engaged to a woman, and she didn't like his music, and she wanted him to leave the music business and get a real job and get married, and he was going down that road until finally. In one of the bands he was in, a singer named Long John Baldry, of which where he gets the name John from. Elton was a member. The name Elton is from Elton Dean, who was in his first band, Bluesology. And then the John part of his name is not from John Lennon, as it was they showed in Rocketman movie. That's not true. It was taken from Long John Baldry, who was a singer with that Bluesology backed up for a while. And it was Long John Baldry who was gay and who told Elton, why are you getting married to this woman? A, she doesn't like your music. B, you're gay. Why are you doing this? So when you hear the song, when you hear the lyric Sugar Bear in Someone Saved My Life Tonight, Sugar Bear, Sugar Bear is Long John Baldry. And he's the person who saved Elton's life by telling him, you can't do this. And Elton ultimately broke off the engagement, continued his music, and became Captain Fantastic. And of course, that song, the band sounds just perfect on that. It's like a 7-minute exorcism. It's probably the most intimate song of Elton's career. And you could feel the swirl of emotions and the passion in Elton's voice. And wow, does Nigel Olsen do a job on the drums in that song, especially the drum fills and one of the great, his drums solos there. We all owe Long John Baldry an eternal debt for what he did for Elton and Bernie and their music. There's a rocker called Gotta Get a Meal Ticket. Once again, talking about agents and promoters and hangers-on and people trying to take advantage of these young songwriters. There's a great song called Better Off Dead, which is a piano-driven kind of banging and pounding song that is inspired by the gritty streets and neighborhoods and the hip crowds of the late 60s and the stark realities of the world and the streets and the nightlife of the town of the times of when they were hanging in their early days, hanging around in these kind of things where artists might hang out and be cool and stuff like that with the in crowd. It's like red light districts. And once again, there's some great drumming and piano playing. Ray Cooper and Nigel and Dee, especially the bass player, and Elton's piano pounding, one of the great songs, which he does that in concert every so often. Then there's this beautiful song called Writing. Got a catchy little title. Once again, some of the best lyrics that Bernie's talked about. It's an idyllic kind of version of how they came together in their writings. Their early days of living together at the different apartments and bonding like brothers, and it's always half and half, and instigation for navigation of our newfound craft. I know you and you know me. It's always half and half. That's their writing. That's their writing partnership. And even at 24 years old, Bernie says, and at the height of their writing and their fame in 1974 and 75, he even asked the question, will we still be writing in approaching years? How prophetic for a 24-year-old, because about 3 years later, they weren't writing anymore for a while. Once again, Bernie Taupin. Wow, what a lyricist and what a poet in many ways. These last two songs, I said before, We All Fall in Love Sometimes. This should have been released as a single. It would have been one of Elton's greatest love songs that everyone would have known. Sadly, it's a song that only the diehards know, but we love it. And it really, I believe, is one of the best songs that they've ever written and recorded. And it's a beautiful, heartfelt recollection of finding a bond and a love and sharing a passion. And there's harmonies and the imagery that Taupin writes with. Once again, there's a line that calls it crackled about rain, and he says it crackled on the speakers and trickled down the sleepy subway trains. Wow, what a great line. And it really talks about how they found each other and fell in love in many ways as brothers. We wrote it and I played it. Something happened. It's so strange, this feeling. Naive notions that were childish, simple tunes that tried to hide it. But when it comes, we all fall in love sometimes. Oh, my gosh. And then, as I said, it ends with the song called Curtains, which kind of ends the story for that period. And it's a climactic, encapsulating the entire journey of when they first got together until the release of their first album. And Bernie makes some very subtle references to their first song they ever wrote together called Scarecrow, another song called The Dandelion Dies in the Wind. Bernie says, I held a dandelion that said the time had come. I used to know this old scarecrow. Those are references to their first songs. Elton would definitely have known exactly what Bernie was talking about. Beneath these branches, I once wrote such childish words for you. As a young kid, writing his first lyrics for Elton as a and childish and naive. He was 17, 16, 17, 18 years old. Admittedly saying these were naive notions and they were childish words, but he developed as a writer. But the imagery and the imagination and the writing skills were there. It just needed to be developed. And this great line of when they got together of a team is, could we, should we? And then, of course, the final line, which sums up the entire album. And just like us, you must have had a once upon a time. And that's what, again, this whole album is. It's like a fairy tale. It's like a fable. It's a once upon a time story. And he perfectly ends it on that note. Oh, I have to tell you, I still can listen to that album from top to bottom. I urge you to celebrate this album, which, as I said, ironically, I think it's Elton's best album ever, and it's his most underappreciated album. People have heard about it. They know about it. They maybe know the history about it, but I don't know how many people, especially casual fans, really have listened to it. So if I've been able to do anything in this podcast today, I hope that I've been able to convey my feelings of why this album was so important to me as an 11-year-old, reeling in all of this Elton mania and then getting this album to just elevate it even more and make an indelible mark in my the core of me, and it still stays with me 50 years later. And to have an album that stands the test of time. As an 11-year-old, I knew this song, this album was great. And 50 years later, it is still great, and it is still being appreciated by those who have come to know it. And my only goal here with this podcast today was to spread the word of Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, the best Elton John and Bernie Taupin album that deserves to be heard, deserves to be appreciated, and deserves to be celebrated for what it is, a great, almost flawless piece of art in every way imaginable. I hope that you will experience this and take from it what you can. But I hope at least, at the very least, you'll give it a listen. From the end of the world to your town. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 494. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.